Coaches. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to From the Trenches, real life in the accounting industry. I'm David Boyer from Sequel CFO, and we are powered by BGL Corp, Australia's leading superannuation and compliance software.
I'm at ZeroCon and here with Bernard Salt, who just gave one of the best, most entertaining talks containing massive amounts of data that I've ever heard in my life. Thanks for coming to ZeroCon and thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. It was great fun and always enjoy working with the Zero team.
Because you've had a bit of a history with the Zero team, because you helped launch the Small Business Insights last year.
Exactly. In September, I thought it was September 11, it stuck in my mind, that date, when Zero released the first of the Business Insights, and I thought it was a terrific product. And certainly gained a lot of attention initially, and I think it's kicked on since then. Whatever success they have, I'm claiming that it's because of my help right at the beginning. That's the politician's trick, isn't it? To claim success, but if it doesn't work, well then that, you know, wasn't my fault.
Yeah, well, you're out of office by the time it falls apart, but you're there for the glory of the PR at the announcement. It's all about the announcement.
That's right, it's all about the announceables. But it was a terrific, and you know, it's a very creative, insightful, and universal database, which I think is the which makes it interesting to people like me.
One of the problems with small business, we keep getting told that big data is going to, you know, wipe us out and change the work. But small business doesn't have big data. We just don't have that much. Small Business Insights kind of aggregates us all together and gives us that opportunity.
Yes, I've heard for many years now that big data is going to swamp everyone and render everyone unemployable. I have a very simple, maybe simplistic, I don't know, view on this. You can have all the whiz-bang data you like, access to whatever information. At some point, somewhere along the line, someone must say, here is what this means and here is what you need to do, Mr. or Ms. CEO or board. So big data is terrific and it's great for the insights it can deliver you, but at some point a person, now whether in fact that's an analyst like me or whether it's a small business financial advisor or accountant, needs to interpret that for the average Joe.
You have a long, successful, and I hope you don't mind the flattery, very highly regarded career. You're a very highly regarded Australian, but you're most famous for avocado on toast, which, are you happy about that or are you disappointed about that? Because when you posted that, the accountants went, yes, this guy's right, we had your back.
Look, it was certainly quite painful at the time. Being at the focal point of so much intensity was not pleasant at the time, and particularly when the column was misinterpreted. It was aimed at baby boomers rather than at the millennial generation. I'm quite happy to parody my own generation, but I would never parody any other generation. But it was, you know, but this is the way with social media, and it's also the way with the media. You can't be in the media as much as I am and for as long as I am without something going awry. I mean, that's just, you know, part of the cost of it all. There's a tremendous benefit that comes with it as well. And I think that Australians have embraced that. Mm. I've suggested that smashed avocado should be our new national dish, in fact.
We got the PAV from New Zealand, so at least this one would be organic.
that's right. In fact, the avocado people are right behind me. Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about the meat pie people or the lamb people, unless you can put lamb with avocado.
I can't imagine Sam Kekovich on an Australian Day avocado ad, unfortunately.
Well, he needs, yeah, this is about thinking laterally. Is you need to merge the yes. The ascendant foodstuffs. So
I'm really curious to know. I mean, I've heard you talk. I read your columns. You were absolutely fantastic today. Really controlled big data and made it relatable. What do you do day to day? Because your job title is a demographer. Is that?
Well, I don't think there is any job called demographer. A demographer is a term that business uses to describe anyone who deals with, you know, vast amounts of consumer information. so it can be a market researcher or someone like myself. What I do on a day-to-day basis, well, my primary purpose, I suppose, is speaking. I speak more than 100 times a year. I write more than 100 columns a year. So if you just multiply out 100 presentations and 100 columns.
I can't, because machine learning does that for me now. Sorry.
Well, that's 200 deliverables just there, plus consulting work or whatever. It's, you know, every day I'm doing something. I'm travelling or speaking. And so I'd be in maybe 3 cities a week speaking. And so I use the hotel nights to write columns. I'll be writing one tonight. You can't do this unless you love it. And I do love it. I enjoy the fun of it all, and I enjoy being slightly whimsical or wry in my commentary, although you can't be too oblique, because with the smashed avocado column, people didn't get that it was satire. But I learned that. You can't protect against that. Here are 750 words. 50 words was, if you take that out, it actually does look very different to when you leave it in context.
Well, John Peterson, who went viral for a whole range of reasons, said that if you have the right to have a thought, then you have the right to offend me, and that should be okay.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, I think it's just part and parcel of modern life. If you're going to be in the media and writing and speaking and commenting and whatever, then, you know, you've got to take the good with the bad.
Well, obviously, as an accounting industry podcast, my co-host and I, Paul Meisner, find ourselves not quite in a smashed avocado situation, but we are described as being controversial every now and then. We like to see it as is. I know that you love what you do, because I walked past you before and I just caught you in between interviews that I've been doing today, and I just got a glimpse of your computer screen and there were just charts on it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this guy just loves it. You said something today, it's not about the data, it's about the story behind the data. Mm. Is that art versus science?
Look, I think that this is my great realisation of spending a year looking at data and interpreting it for business. This was a revelation. You know, I don't know how it came to me, but actually, you know, it isn't about the data. There is a story. There is a greater story. Data is just little points in time or whatever. There is a narrative there that's happening, and data enables you to build up that picture, and it's up to you to bring that out and to see colour and movement and momentum and the rise and fall of different markets or different businesses, and then to say, here is what the landscape is actually saying. That, to me, is far more interesting to say, well, you know, population growth was 2%, whatever.
Rates unchanged.
Right, that's right. So it's that which people respond to, because you are then talking about the future. If you're talking about a narrative, you say, this is where we were, this is where we are, then by implication, that's where we're going, and we need to change the direction, or we need to invest in order to cope with that or whatever. That's why the story is so important.
As a financial mentor, I have access to a lot of data on my own business, on my client's business. Mm-hmm. How do I learn how to storytell with this data?
How do you storytell? You need to make sure your data is right, tight, correct. The first thing is to check the provenance of the data. There's all sorts of data out there that's crap. You need to make sure that it's rock solid, that it's got a good foundation. And then you need to get up high, almost like in outer space, and then look down and say, what are these sets of numbers saying? If you had to sum this up in one sentence, what would you say? As silly as it sounds, and as not got quite the right words, that was something else I learned very early in my presenting career. Say what you need to say in order to communicate the point you want to make. Don't think, I don't know quite the right word for this, and I will make up words. I will talk about the wealthification of Australia, or the Chinification of Australia, or the lonelyfication of Australia. People love it. People love you being direct and a bit creative and a bit quirky, and they'll remember that, in fact. So be yourself, and use whatever language or words you need in order to communicate the point.
Would you say that you are a larrikin with the Australian vernacular then?
I'm not sure that people call me a larrikin. Pretty middle class. Middle class larrikin. I would like to think I'm sort of a raised eyebrow provocateur occasionally.
Like that.
That's as far as I go. So I'm not sort of there fermenting revolution.
I like to think of our show as a constructive provocateurs.
That's very good.
Not critical for no reason. You had some fantastic insight today. I want to focus on two things. Mm-hmm. What are some of your favourite abbreviations to describe what's happening in Australia?
You mean like in terms of acronyms, that sort of thing? Well, in fact...
Acronyms.
Yes. Well, you can't be in the business of demographics and not have acronyms, you know, like yuppies and dinks. I remember when I first heard those terms back in the 1980s, they were the most interesting things. They came out of California, of course. That was where demography and social commentary really emerged. And I took to making them up. Thought, well, you know, I did. Pumpkins, P-U-M-C-I-N-S, professional urban middle class in nice suburbs. I remember when I invented that, I was at my kitchen table and I thought, professional urban middle class, punk, and then in nice suburbs, just, oh, that is beautiful.
Well done, Bertie. Let's have a red and go to bed.
I thought that one's going to fly. I knew right there. And the Oz loved it, the Australian loved it, and they did a big picture story on page 3. Same thing with nettles, not enough time to enjoy life. Kippers actually came out of America, and Lombards, L-O-M-B-A-R-D-S, lots of money but a real dickhead. I don't know where that came from. Someone else invented that.
It came from Bondi. It came from Bondi Beach.
Interestingly, I put that in my presentations, and many businesses won't allow the presentation through their firewall because... dickhead is such a foul word, apparently.
Well, Zero's keynote speaker was Mark Manson, who wrote a book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F-U Star K.
Right, okay, yes. Well, I'm at the far other end of the spectrum on that.
You have access to massive amounts of data. You crunch numbers because you ask creative questions, and you presented a lot today. What was your favourite topic? What was your favourite slide?
Well, I suppose the more I do, and the older you get, the more you are concerned about the bigger picture issues rather than the operational issues. You know, is there going to be more growth next year than last year, that sort of thing. I think that's the issues that focus the mind in your 20s, 30s, maybe even your 40s. Later on, you tend to think about the bigger picture issues. And the thing that I'm concerned about is our anti-business sentiment. And you would have to say that the zeitgeist, the prevailing mindset in Australia at the moment is anti-business. If you've been successful in business, then you must have got there through nefarious means.
Beyond tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah, it is. It's and yet the reality is that people who take risks, invest their capital, create a business, employ people, pay tax, be good corporate citizens, in my view, certainly the people that I have had experience with, and maybe I'm a bit Pollyannish about this, but I find people are very honest, are very fair. I mean, I get it that there are cowboys and so forth, but to actually paint the entire community that way, I think is very wrong. I feel very sorry for people in some of these big institutions, which I won't name, there's been a problem. And, you know, you can be, 10 rungs down, doing a very diligent job, going to work, all that sort of thing, and you have to wear the opprobrium of associated guilt. And it's, we need to be more mature about this, I think.
I became a business banker in 2011. Not a good time to become a banker if you're worried about social status of your job title.
Yes, I suppose. But... The reality is that we need and understand this program is geared to small business, which is really, without doubt, the backbone of the Australian economy.
Accounting services.
But the reality is that you do need big businesses who have a vast country, enormous country with resources, requiring not just a few thousand dollars to develop something. You want to develop a mine, it takes tens, hundreds of millions of dollars to sit out there for a decade or more before you actually get a return on that. Well, I'm sorry, you need really big business to be focused on this. That needs to go across different administrations. We need to be mature enough as a people to say, you know what, that is going to deliver wealth and prosperity and taxation, quality of life to the Australian people. We need to get behind it.
Do you think, on these big projects, Victoria just announced a massive $50 billion vision for a railway project. They don't even know the stations that it's going to have. It's a vision. It's just a vision. It's politically a very well-timed attack on the Victorian Liberal Party, I think. Do projects like that tick the box for you, or are you looking for it in private enterprise, not government funded?
Look, I'm aware of that project, and I'm certainly a great fan of visioning. And I think we should be thinking about our cities in 2050, how fluid they are and what sort of infrastructure we need. I can remember, I'm from Melbourne, and I can remember in 1996, it was like, you know, still 4 or 5 years after the recession, Melbourne was still on its knees. But CityLink was under construction. That's the M1, you know, drawing together the whole of Melbourne. It was a Kennett initiative, of course. It was $4 billion. I distinctly remember you could not walk down Collins Street, or I could not walk down Collins Street, without bumping into someone that wasn't a contractor, a lawyer, an accountant, dealing with that project. It was like you know, those things that defibrillators that had been applied to Melbourne, and Melbourne was sparking and jumping as a consequence. And I say that I don't think Melbourne has looked back since that time. So in that example, I think that infrastructure was well timed, and that it had, you know, $4 billion was enough to defibrillate a city of 3.5 million people into action for a generation. Now, it probably requires more than $4 billion today, and maybe $50 billion is it, or whatever it is. But certainly projects of that scale really can make a difference, I think. And rightly so. I mean, if we're going to take Melbourne and Sydney from 4 and 5 million people to 8 million people over a generation, then we really need to be world's best practice at infrastructure development, city management, and delivering fluidity. Otherwise, we end up with a city of 8 million people where it just collapses under its own weight and you can't actually get around. That's not the sort of city I have in mind, or country I have in mind, for that next generation.
A very close friend of mine says that these projects are great, but we can't build this stuff in Australia because the politics of it ruins the projects. And it almost makes you long for the Chinese one-party system where we're going to build something, it gets built because there's no one there to say no.
It's very, very interesting. My wife and I spend a month in Europe every year. We have a son over there. And you might turn up to this, you know, little town in France or Italy or whatever, maybe 5,000-6,000 people or so, and you turn up and there's this Duomo that was built in the 1300s or 1400s, and you look at the history and it took 120 years. How did 6,000 people 500 years ago, over the course of 100 years, actually build that, finance it, leverage resources to deliver? We couldn't do that. We can't do that as a state. But, you know, I suppose the point there is that you need the political system, you know, the church state, and virtual slavery. But the point is,
other than that,
apart from that, the outcome is still very good. Yeah. Still very good. But again, you know, do we have the right structures in place, and do the Australian people have the ability to forego what else you could do with that money now in order to secure something better for the future? In other words, here is $20 billion. Do you want us to spend that on welfare programs now, or would you like us to spend that on a piece of infrastructure that will improve the quality of life for all Melburnians in 15 or 20 years' time? You know, the old issue of self-interest comes to the fore. Well, you know, I don't see the benefit of that. I want to see the benefit of that before I would actually support it. We need to change that thinking.
I want to change topic just a little bit. Entrepreneurship is a sexy phrase. It's a very, very sexy word. Mm. What's the difference between entrepreneurship and just your regular small business owner who every year makes a decision to risk it all and go again?
Well, I don't think there is any difference. An entrepreneur is someone that has a go, that is prepared to put their money where their mouth is, who has actually risk something in order to achieve something. And I say that if you're going to do that, then you need to be appropriately rewarded. And I think that as a society, we need to be truthful amongst ourselves and say, they're doing something that I can't do. Good on them. And, you know, if they pay their taxes, they're a good corporate citizen, they employ people and they're not destroying the environment or hurting anyone, but legitimately generating wealth and prosperity for the Australian people, why is that not the greatest contribution to our nation? Instead of, how'd you bastards get to be so rich?
My fanboy level just went from 10 to 15 to you. My final question for you is about Aussie farmers. Yeah. Been doing it tough for a very long time, but as far as the press are concerned, they've only been doing it tough the last 2 weeks, unless you watch Landline as religiously as I do. It's my favourite show. I'm an urbanite, so Landline's my connection to the soil of the land. Are Aussie farmers Australia's most unrespected, unregarded entrepreneurs?
Well, if you look at the census to see where people who work for themselves live, it's regional Australia. Yeah. It's about 150,000 farmers or growers, graziers, whatever you call them. And some of them can be quite huge enterprises. I was in the wheat belt of Western Australia about 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, there's farmers there that have vast amounts of territory that they're farming. You know, they're buying out the neighbour and so forth. These are multi-million dollar agribusinesses. And in addition to that, you have the little dairy farm in, say, Gippsland, for example, which might be one-man band, that sort of thing. So it's a wide variation. But we should be world's best practice at agribusiness. I will say that I think we lost an opportunity 20 years ago, 30 years ago, to create a global agribusiness business. We have a global agribusiness, a global business in mining, which is BHP. Rio Tinto also, although that's anchored in London, not in Melbourne anymore. We should have a global enterprise that came out of wool, then moved into cotton, then moved into meat packaging and whatever. We've sort of, and if you look at, we've outsourced all that. All our dairy is now owned by the New Zealanders at Fonterra and Parmalat and Saputo out of Canada. I'm concerned that we are conceding sovereignty in parts of the economy to other places. And as a proud, patriotic Australian, I reckon we should be controlling the resources from growing to adding value to then distribution.
Government buyback scheme of national resources is my solution for that one. I don't think that'll ever happen. We've run out of time, Bernard. Thank you very much for talking to us. Any final messages to all the accountants out there?
A final message would be to follow your dreams. Don't let anyone tell you that accounting is not creative.
Fanboy level 30 now.
doesn't add value, really, I think, is the fundamental glue that drives our economy.
Thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of From the Trenches. David and I love hearing feedback from all of our listeners. If you ever have any content, feel free to reach out. I can be reached at Paul Meissner on LinkedIn or on Twitter at Fiveways Group.
I'm on Twitter at David Boyar, B-O-Y-A-R, on LinkedIn, David Boyar.